ready to go. Good evening, Tamara. Welcome. Most of you, welcome back. Some of you, I think, welcome. This is actually our fourth meeting, our fourth session in the highlights of the Talmudic, of the Rabbinic Portrait. What was it called? The Talmudic Portrait Gallery, Rabbinic Portrait Gallery. So I thought it would be helpful to put a bit of a timeline now on the board so that we've accumulated, maybe at this point we're accumulating enough names and enough characters to get a bit of a picture of chronology and time. So I want to just quickly remind you, and then we'll add a couple of names yet still to this chart. So we started way back when, we started with the post-destruction generation, with the generation of the students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself maybe is the rabbinic figure most associated personally with the story of the destruction of Jerusalem and that transition from Jerusalem to Yavne. His students, which we started with five of his students mentioned by the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, are really that first generation of post-destruction rabbinic figures who are spearheading, struggling to put together, to create, to determine what will be the face of Jewish religious life, Jewish communal life, now in this new reality after the destruction of the temple. And we looked at more carefully at Rabbi Lazar, two of those five students, Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, Rabbi Lezer ben Horkanus, and I think through their stories we already recognize how this is a struggle, or there's a battle, might be an overstatement, but might not be, a struggle over what will the face of this new Judaism be, what will the face of this world of Torah be like. Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, the ultimate creative individual spirit, will it be ultra conservative with a lowercase c? Is it all about being a water cistern that never loses a drop? Is it about being an overflowing fountain? And we saw basically the rabbinic answer was it's about neither, or it's neither one or the other. It's certainly not the extreme one or the extreme other. Possibly, and this is what we did last week, what we are actually looking at is the Rabbi Akiva model. The Rabbi Akiva model, which I believe someone said already last week, seems to be trying to hold on to both the creative impulse and yet also the conserving, preserving, structured, right, traditional impulse, and the world of Midrash, which is really that attempt to hold on to both sides of the coin. And it looks like the world of Rabbi Akiva is indeed, more than anyone else that we've seen so far, is really the model for the rabbinic world as it's emerging from this post-destruction generation. Rabbi Akiva is a generation, or maybe even more accurately, he is younger. He is of a younger generation than the immediate post-destruction generation. He is not one of the students of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. He's one generation removed from them. Remember, he had a late start, right? We spoke about that as well last week. So maybe the gap in age between this generation of students and himself might not be that dramatic, but he is, in terms of his position, he is their student. He is the next generation already of students. So we basically come now, by Rabbi Akiva's time, we've come nearly two full generations away from the destruction. Of course, Rabbi Akiva's age was also a very traumatic moment in history. This is where the Bar Kokhba revolt is taking place, and certainly very, very traumatic and dramatic events are taking place in his time as well. We're going to go back again, and that's one of the reasons that I put the timeline on, so as not to confuse you. Today's personality, today's character that we're going to be focusing on is moving back again, one back to this generation. Rabban Gamliel, who we're going to be interested in tonight, is part still of this post-destruction generation. We jumped a bit ahead to Rabbi Akiva. We're moving back again. He is a contemporary of Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, Rabbi Lezer ben Horkanus, this immediately post-generation, post-destruction generation. We jumped ahead with Rabbi Akiva because for thematic reasons, I wanted to look at Rabbi Akiva immediately on the tail end of these two, right, former characters, but now we're moving back to just complete our picture with Rabban Gamliel still back in that original post-destruction generation. There's one more name I want to put on the board here. Not that we, of course, right, we didn't devote an entire session to him, but he's definitely been present in many of the stories that we've already, in some of the stories that we've already read, and he will be present in some of the stories that we'll read tonight, and that is Rabbi Yoshua as well, right, who we've come across already a number of times. He too was one of those five students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai mentioned originally in that first Mishnah. He played a very, very central role in the story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, right, just to remind you, he is not only the one who kisses the stone and says this man is like the Ark of the Covenant, but he is also the one that was primarily active in the very dramatic events of the Oven of Achnai story. He is the one that stood on his feet and said, Lo b'shamayim, he is the one that really spearheads this rebellion, as it were, this rejection of the ultimate model of the Bor Sud She'ino Me'abed Tipa, and he is the one that establishes the Beit Midrash, leads, as it were, right, is most active, or depicted as being most active in establishing this new rabbinic Beit Midrash with Lo b'shamayim he engraved over the mantle, right, mantelpiece of the entrance to the world. So Rabbi Yoshua, we've already come across some of his imagery has come through some of the other stories, and we will continue to see Rabbi Yoshua playing a role in Rabban Gamliel's life as well. So I'm putting him on the board because he's there, okay? He's definitely there. Okay, let's start with a bit of an introduction to Rabban Gamliel. And the truth is, we actually have already been introduced to Rabban Gamliel as well. Not only Rabbi Yoshua made an appearance in the stories of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, but Rabban Gamliel did as well. And I want us to recall for a moment, our first exposure to Rabban Gamliel, even before tonight, was once again through the events narrated around the Oven of Achnai, around the excommunication and rejection of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus and the model that he represented within the rabbinic story, right? I want to quickly remind you in that story, after Rabbi Yoshua, after the events unfold, and Rabbi Akiva is sent, okay, to tell Rabbi Eliezer, only Rabbi Akiva, as we said before, can possibly in any way inform Rabbi Eliezer that he's being excommunicated and not destroy the world. Immediately following that, we watch, right, the ripples go through the world, the impacts go through the world, and we had all kinds of descriptions of how the world reels, right, in response to this, such a dramatic moment. And then we had a scene. If you remember, Rabban Gamliel was on a ship and a wave threatened to drown him, and Rabban Gamliel's immediate response was, I know that this is all about Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus, and then he pleads to God, please, right, I did what I did for your sake, and the wave subsides. Rabban Gamliel then appears again at the end of the story when finally Rabbi Eliezer's wife, who is his sister, and leaves off her vigilance for a couple of moments, leading to the death of Rabban Gamliel. So basically, even before we read his life story, we've already read about his death. Rabban Gamliel will eventually die as a result of the excommunication of Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus. But I think when we read the story already then, we noted to ourselves how odd it was and how strange it was that he was not mentioned at all in the first half of the story. In other words, as the events were unfolding themselves, he wasn't mentioned. It was not Rabban Gamliel who got up on his feet and said, Lo b'shamayim he. It was not Rabban Gamliel who sent the message. It was not Rabban Gamliel who delivered the message to Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanus. And yet he seems to bear the brunt of the effect, okay, of the backlash of that event of excommunicating Rabbi Eliezer. And that, I think, already is the beginning of our first indication of something about the character of Rabban Gamliel and who he is. Why does he bear the brunt and the impact of that deed when he didn't seem to have personally been involved, or he certainly wasn't described as being the primary mover behind all of that? Why does he bear the responsibility? Because he's the Nasi. Because he's the patriarch. And already we have an indication that Rabban Gamliel has a public office, has a position, and he holds, if not personal responsibility, he holds ministerial responsibility for everything that goes on within the confines of the Beit Midrash. Rabban Gamliel is not just an individual, is not a person, is not only a person. Rabban Gamliel represents, holds office, and in that capacity of holding office, he bears responsibilities for things that take place that he might not have individually either manipulated or created or even been directly involved in, but he still holds ultimate responsibility. So we already have an indication about something very central about his character.
Was he the head of the Sanhedrin at that point?
He was, okay? He was, as his title indicates. It's our second indication. He is the only one so far that we've come across that carries the title Rabban and not Rabbi, okay? And not Rabbi. And Rabban, again, Rabban does seem to be an exclusive title that's held only by those who occupy this office of Nasi, okay, often translated into English as patriarch. What exactly is this office? Okay, what defines it? Who defines it? Okay, who occupies this position is something that we will talk about as we continue tonight. But it does seem to be very clearly already in that initial first story, our first reading of Rabban Gamliel in the Tanurosh Lachrai story, is that he's more than just an individual. He holds responsibility because he holds office, right? Whatever that office is.
Was he a student of Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai,
okay,
or just...
Good question. He was not mentioned. When the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot mentioned the five outstanding students of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he was absent from that list, okay? I would almost say glaringly absent from that list. You know what? Let's already put that here as a question mark, maybe a question mark, exclamation mark. Why wasn't Rabban Gamliel mentioned? Was he not a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai? And if he wasn't a student, then why wasn't he a student? Well, I think we'll explore more about that, or we'll maybe know a bit more about that by the end of this evening. One other thing we know about Rabban Gamliel, even just based on what we've already read about him in that Tanurosh Lachnai story that we looked at 2 weeks ago, okay? Rabban Gamliel, in that story, if you remember the content of his plea to God when threatened by this terrible wave, right? And he says, I know that's because, and then he turns to God and he says what? I don't know, you don't have the text in front of you, so I'll try and quote as best as possible. He says the following. He says, Lo lema ani asiti, velo lebet abba asiti. Okay, ki im lich shelo yirbu machlokot b'Israel, so that machlokot will not be multiplying in Israel. And he speaks very strongly there of a concept. He talks about a bit abba, okay? A patriarchal home. He talks about his bit abba. He mentions bit abba. It's particularly also striking because there's one other person in that story who also mentions a bit abba, and that is none other than, go back to the story when you get home, if you still have it at home, look at it again and you'll see. In that same story, there's another individual who mentions his bit abba, and that's none other than Rabbi Eliezer's wife, who we all remember is Rabban Gamliel's sister. So we have a brother and a sister, Rabban Gamliel and his sister, mention their Beit Abba, which gives us an indication about something about this man. This man also belongs to and has as an identity, as part of his identity, his lineage. Okay, and we can't even start reading Rabban Gamliel's stories until we make note of who that Beit Abba is. And why does it play such a strong role in Rabban Gamliel's own perception of who he is and his own identity? So Rabban Gamliel is the patriarch, but he also comes from a dynasty of patriarchs, of Nisi'im. If the rabbinic world, if the Talmudic world has a royal family, this is it, okay? This is it. Rabban Gamliel is born into that royal family. And actually, it's so striking that it actually highlights the fact that we don't have many rabbinical dynasties in the Mishnaic and Talmudic world. We have on occasion a Talmid Chacham, some great rabbi whose son also is a great rabbi, but even that isn't very consistent. We have many strong rabbinic figures, about whom their children, their sons, we know nothing about. And we don't have a sense that rabbinic families or dynasties, I'm talking about the Mishnaic Talmudic world, okay, not later. But Mishnaic Talmudic, we don't have a sense that rabbinic positions or rabbinic stature is inherited. With this one exception. This one family that occupies the seat of the patriarchy continuously for nearly 10 generations. It originates with the founder of this dynasty is none other than Hillel. Hillel HaZaken, the founder of Beit Hillel as well. This is a man who founds not only a genealogical dynasty, but he also founds an entire school, right, otherwise known as Beit Hillel. But Hillel also is appointed in a drama that is actually narrated by the Talmud in a number of places. Hillel is, as particularly the Talmud Bavli likes to remind us, originated from Bavel. Hillel came from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, and for various reasons, which the Talmud does depict in great detail, events develop that cause his appointment, right, create his appointment as the Nasi. The Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael receives this Ole Chadash, right, this recent Ole, and actually appoints him patriarch. And that sets in motion this dynasty. Hillel has a son named Shimon, about whom we don't know too much more than his name. Shimon, in turn, has a son named Gamliel. Okay. Now, these two names, Shimon and Gamliel, are going to repeat in this dynasty, as happens in dynasty. It's like, I don't know what the kings of England are all like, Georges and Charles. So the patriarchs are, many of them are Shimons and Gamliels, are very, very... So we have this Gamliel. Okay. This Gamliel still lives in the time of the temple, right? Hillel was appointed patriarch still when the temple still stands. And so his son after him, and his grandson after him. This is Rabban Gamliel, sometimes known as Rabban Gamliel HaZaken, Rabban Gamliel the Elder, who still lives in the time up until the last few decades of the existence of Beit Sheni, the Second Temple. Rabban Gamliel has a son named Shimon, okay? Who was the first Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel? Okay, the first Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel the first, if you wish, although he's never called that in the Talmud. In order to distinguish him from a Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel who's coming up in the next couple of generations, he is sometimes, unfortunately, called Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel.
Rashbag?
Well, no, yes, okay. But both of them would be Rashbag. No, he is, to distinguish him from the next Rabban Gamliel, he is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel HaNehirag, the one who was killed. And that already gives you a little bit of a, more than a little bit of an idea, of something that, this particular patriarchal figure coincides now, I wish I had it coinciding with the board, the time of the destruction. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the patriarch, is killed in the war of the revolt, in the Great Revolt. He is killed, and as part of those events that lead to the destruction of the temple, he himself loses his life in the great those dramatic and violent events of the Great Revolt. He has a son whose name is, you can guess, Gamliel. Okay. This Rabban Gamliel the second, okay, is the Rabban Gamliel that we're going to speak about this evening. Rabban Gamliel II, Rabban Gamliel born to a father who is killed in the events of the Great War, of the Great Revolt. He is sometimes, in order to distinguish him from his grandfather, called Rabban Gamliel of Yavne, okay? In order to distinguish him from Rabban Gamliel the Elder, who lived still in Jerusalem at the time of the temple itself. Just to make the story complete, have a second, this Rabban Gamliel has a son, Shimon, who is Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel the second, okay, the one who survives, right, the one who does not get killed. And Rabban Shimon Gamliel the second has a son, a very important individual, whose name is Yehuda, who is, of course, none other than Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who will publish and produce the Mishnah. Now, the dynasty might climax with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and I think in rabbinic narrative, to a large extent, we will see that in 2 weeks' time. We'll talk about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and all the rhetoric around Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is going to create that sense that something has come to fruition, right? That almost all of these generations have been building up to get to this point of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. But the dynasty does not still end even with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and it continues for nearly another 5 generations. After the publication of the Mishnah, after a lot of the focus of attention of rabbinic activity has already now transitioned to Babel, there is still a dynasty, a Hillel-descended dynasty, still active in Eretz Yisrael up until nearly the end of the Talmudic period, okay? In spite of the fact that in terms of their position and stature within the rabbinic world, none of his descendants come close to having the stature that certainly Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi himself had, and even some of the rabbinic figures before him. Yes?
Trivial question. Is Shimon ben Gamliel? There's no Gamliel ben Shimon. Why?
Well, there is. He, technically speaking, he's never called that.
That's right. One pair are called with their father's name, the other pair aren't.
Okay. I don't know.
Rabbi Shimon's. To confuse them with.
I don't know, because I really don't know
okay.
why.
It's not your favorite. You're
right.
But
just
There's a Rabbi Gamliel who's buried in Beit Sha'arim, who I think is the son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi.
Yes. Yehuda, Yehanasi continues.
Another Gamliel.
There are another Gamliels, another Shimons and Yehudas coming up. Okay. Until finally, nicely and neatly, the last of this generation with whom the patriarchy dissolves is finally named Hillel. Mm. So there's a nice closure there. But I don't know if those people who find that is important is significant. Okay.
There was no Nasi before?
Unclear. Do you know, unclear. Did the position of Nasi emerge with Hillel? If there was, there's a concept of B'nai B'teira, which seemed to be just like a faceless group, kind of a, not an individual that we can point at and say he was the Nasi before. I want to say two other things, maybe, and then we'll move to finally begin to read some of our texts for tonight. One is, conveniently enough, okay, or interestingly enough, at some point as this dynasty is establishing itself, and by the way, nowhere, at least as far as I'm aware of, within rabbinic literature, is there any tension around the fact that this office seems to be inherited from father to son. It seems to be taken as a given that it would rightly be transferred from father to son, from father to son. And conveniently or interestingly enough also, the Talmud tells us that at the time of Hillel, a scroll of genealogy is revealed that traces Hillel's lineage back to none other, of course, than the house of David, Bidiu. Which, of course, allows for some of this to, wraps all of this with an extra wrapping of royalty, first of all, royalty, and legitimacy, and maybe even the sense of inheritance, and maybe even, shall we say it, we'll say it, by the end of this evening I'll have to say the word, and we'll have to say it again when we get to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, maybe also overtones of messianism and messianic hopes, some of that, all of this, the sense of belonging or continuing the house of David is somehow also associated with this whole dynasty. Let's start now focusing on this Rabban Gamliel, the Rabban Gamliel that we're interested in.
Small question. Bakshan. Are all these first sons or only sons?
I don't know the answer to that. I know the answer to that question in some cases, not in all. I know for sure Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi makes sure to appoint in his in not necessarily his older son. I don't know if there's information about the others. Okay, let's start looking at Rabban Gamliel because he's of interest to us tonight. So first of all, his biography, just what we know already of him. Here's a man who lost his father. The dynasty was interrupted. This long, right, continuous dynasty. It crosses these events, historical events, lead to the early death, the violent death of his father. So that Rabban Gamliel is now born into a historical reality where converging on his personal life, I think, are two very intense realities that I want us to appreciate even before we start our stories. He is born into an interrupted dynasty. An interrupted dynasty. Now that also precisely happens to be the one interruption, the one exception to this continuous line of patriarchs from father to son and father to son for 10 generations. There's one exception, and that is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Who, as you can see by his title, seems to have also held the position that we associate with the patriarchy. Now, why? The reason is Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai really, okay, moves in precisely at this point. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel I is killed. And apparently, Rabban Gamliel, his son, is not quite ready yet to take over. And therefore, the dynasty is interrupted. And momentarily, or at least for the moment, someone else, someone huge, right? Someone with certainly the ability takes over that position. And until his death, the dynasty is interrupted and is in different hands. And it's not until Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai dies that Rabban Gamliel retakes or reoccupies and reestablishes the dynasty of his ancestors in the position of the patriarch. Right now, I often ask myself, why was that interruption, or what was the cause of that interruption? And one simple answer might be, why didn't Rabban Gamliel immediately take over? Why is there this need for Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai to fill the office for those number of years until Rabban Gamliel takes over from him? Well, one simple answer is maybe
he's too young,
okay? Rabban Gamliel might just not be young. And we hear of royalty, you know, royal, that happens when the royalty is too young, so someone takes over, and then... And by the way, one of the interesting things that I also find very interesting is that nowhere in rabbinic literature, again to the best of my knowledge, is there any question or doubt that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai finishes his term, right, when he passes on, it's smoothly, the transition back to Rabban Gamliel is clear and smooth and obvious. There's no tension about Rabban Gamliel sort of reassigning himself. So the transition, at least it didn't leave a scar, didn't leave a mark in rabbinic literature as being tense in any way. But one possibility is he was too young. But there is, of course, another possibility. He's not only too young, but it also might be that he's not quite ready yet to take on. I mean, he's been through a very traumatic experience. He has not only lost his father, right, communally, publicly, right, Am Yisrael has lost the temple. There's been this horrible, this violent period of revolt. He personally has lost his father. It's also possible that he's not capable of taking on this mantle of leadership, not only because of his age, but possibly he needs time. Maybe he needs time, and it's the time precisely that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gives him, so that he can collect himself and take back, right, reestablish the line of his fathers. On the other hand, or not on the other hand, continuing that idea, that is a huge burden for anyone to have on their shoulders. That knowledge that a dynasty has been interrupted, and it's my responsibility, it's my task, it's my destiny, it's my responsibility to continue the line that was established generations ago, right? It is now my responsibility to lift up that mantle and put it on my shoulders and bear the burden, right? Bear that that task, that assignment. Both for the sake of the people, for the sake of my ancestors. That's a huge burden to have on anybody's shoulders, and it's something that I want us to keep in mind as we begin to read Rabbi Gamliel's story.
Even more so if you take the Old Torah.
Yes. Okay.
That's like, I think, even bigger.
Okay, so he's got converging on this one individual are a lot of responsibilities. This is an example of someone who is born into a fate. Born into a destiny, you wonder about, right, his sense of freedom to have choice. Does he have a choice here? Right, he is marked, right? He is marked and singled out. His circumstances singled him out for this role, and he has to take it. He has to take it in a particular and reestablish this dynasty, this line in very, very problematic historical circumstances. Okay, keeping all of that in mind, let's start reading. Okay, let's start reading. Where he's coming from, what his responsibilities are, and where he's heading. The Mishnah in Brachot. I want to read a collection of Mishnahs, Mishnayot, that appear in Masechet Brachot. They're very well known, not only because they're in Masechet Brachot, and a lot of people study Masechet Brachot, but because I think they also highlight and float to the surface a tension or an issue that has always been, I think, on people's minds, but probably in our times, maybe even somewhat more than others. Okay, here we are. A bridegroom, the Mishnah is talking about Kriyat Shema, about the obligation to recite Kriyat Shema twice a day, b'shochvecha u'bekumecha, nachon, biblically we have the responsibility, at least the rabbis read the psukim, to recite the Shema, the receiving sort of the kingship of God, ol malchut shamayim, morning and evening. And then the Mishnah, amongst other things, tells us the following. A bridegroom is exempt from reciting the Shema from the first night until the end of the Sabbath, until Motzei Shabbat, okay, if he has not consummated his marriage. Right? So on the first night of your wedding, the Mishnah teaches, a chatan is exempt from reciting the Shema on the first night and leading up to possibly also the second night, possibly also the third night, up until Motzei Shabbat. For as long as he has not yet consummated the marriage, he has an exemption from saying the Shema. Now, we don't have much time, but I will just say that the Talmud Bavli, when commenting on this Mishnah, as well as, by the way, the Talmud Yerushalmi, both Talmudim are in agreement that what we're looking at here is a manifestation of a halachic principle that is invoked in a number of places, and that is the idea of ha'osek b'mitzvah patur mi'mitzvah. One who is occupied in the performance of one mitzvah may be exempted from the performing at the same time another mitzvah. And that principle is, I think, to me today, it's a very interesting principle because it has something to do with multitasking, okay, which is such a, you know, such a fashionable term nowadays, okay? It's a recognition of the fact that people have limited capacities to do things, maybe to do them well. And if you're involved with a mitzvah, especially if it is a mitzvah that requires focus and attention, and is preoccupies your thoughts and feelings and whatever, like the mitzvah of the chatan right on his wedding night, you can't require someone to free their mind or to free themselves to also perform. And a halachic system, the halacha, recognizes that and exempts you. That if you're occupied with one mitzvah, you do not have to, you're exempt from performing the other, okay? Now, the extent of that principle, when do we apply it, when do we not apply it, is, of course, very interesting, but this is one of the prime examples, the Talmud Bavli and the Talmud Yerushalmi believe, of ha'osek b'mitzvah patur mi'mitzvah. Mitzuyan. The Mishnah then continues and tells us the following. It happened that when Rabban Gamliel got married, he recited the Shema on the first night. And already now we have an introduction of a tension between a halacha and a maaseh, okay? We have a normative halachic principle codified in broadly and generally as a normative principle, and then we have an anecdote, a maaseh, of someone who is described as doing something. Now, the relationship bichlal in Mishnah and in rabbinic literature in general between halacha and maaseh, right, descriptions or codifications of general principles, and then an actual anecdote is a very interesting relationship to trace in many contexts. This particular context highlights, of course, a tension that immediately we see that Rabban Gamliel, in his own personal life, did not follow the practice that the Mishnah a moment ago prescribed, right? The Mishnah prescribed, if you're doing a mitzvah, you're exempt from performing the mitzvah of Shema. And Rabban Gamliel chose to do differently, to do otherwise. He did not accept this exemption. He did not apply this exemption to himself. He did not think that ha'osek b'mitzvah patur mi'mitzvah, or at least he didn't think that it applied to himself. And in his own personal life, on his wedding night, he said the Shema anyway. Okay? Okay.
Curious about what it means exempt. Does it mean it's required?
Okay, yafeh, mitzuyan. So you're saying, okay, yafeh. So usually you think what he did was he waived the exemption. He said, yes, you have an option if you wish not to. All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But at least, again, the way the Mishnah sort of suggested, or the way the Mishnah is perceived, is that it talks about the fact that it's very difficult to do two things at once. And the promoting, of course, the choice is, if you're occupied with these two mitzvot, do this one and not this one. Okay, so, and then Rabban Gamliel says, no, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to do both. I can do both. I will do both. In a minute, we'll see. He'll explain himself in just a minute. Third clause of the Mishnah, or the third section of that Mishnah, his disciples said to him, Okay? The tension is, of course, coming through already. Not the tension, but the fact that the maaseh, the anecdote, is not quite following the normative prescription that began at the beginning. We noticed that ourselves. But just to intensify that, we have an appearance now of a choir, okay? We have a Greek choir that appears all of a sudden. We have the disciples, and the disciples come out and say, Master, have you not taught us that a bridegroom is exempt from the recital of the Shema? Making it even more intense, because it's not just an abstract Mishnaic principle that Rabban Gamliel is not following. The disciples say, Master, you taught us that Mishnah. We have now caught you in an inconsistency. Yesterday in school, in the Bet Midrash, you taught us that a bridegroom is exempt. And now we watch you on your own wedding night not following your own instructions or deviating from your instructions. Now, there's a lot of tension there. There's a lot of tension between the law as it's codified and formulated for the tzibur, right, for the community, and the sense that the individual is not, right, he's being... is being revealed here, is being exposed here, is not practicing what he himself preaches. Okay, to an extent. What? What are you all?
We're laughing. Well, I was thinking the students sitting under the bed. Like
yes,
that.
Okay, the disciples, yes. So very often. What are the disciples doing there? Okay, so what are they doing? Where are we, first of all? We don't know. A minute ago, we thought we were, by the way, I don't know how many of you were embarrassed a minute ago when the Mishnah was describing what Rabban Gamliel did on his wedding night. Nahon? We might have already felt, to a certain extent, I think what the Mishnah does is the Mishnah turns us into one of those disciples. We also were there watching Rabban Gamliel in his bedroom on his wedding
Couldn't
night.
Couldn't it just be that the next day he came to class and in the process of talking about Shema, he said, last night when I was saying Shema, blah, 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 you know, like...
Could be. What? Or he went to Minyan, okay, and then everybody says to you, what are you doing here? Okay, no, whatever it is, what's floating to the surface, I think, a little bit, on multiple levels, is the tension between the individual and the individual's choices in their own private and personal practice, and between the normative behavior that's codified for the community, for the general group, right, in them as depicted, as described in the first part of the Mishnah. And Rabban Gamliel lives in this, in a particular intent. Now, all of us, to a certain extent, live in a certain tension between ourselves as private individuals and ourselves as belonging to communities. Rabban Gamliel lives, however, in this tension in a particularly intensified way. Public figures tend to live in much more intense ways than many of ourselves in exactly this kind of position. They're watched, they're followed, okay? And even if it's telling them that... People are interested in the way you live your private life, and they cross-reference all the time. Are you living in your private life the way is your public persona and your private life, how do they match up? Right? And that's part of being a public figure, is living with that tension and living with that exposure and living with those paparazzi, right? Those paparazzi students who jump up and say, oh, I just saw you do this, and the next thing you know, your picture's plastered all over, right? And everyone's saying, wait a second, how could you have done this? You taught us this. And it's a huge tension to live within. Now, he explains himself, Rabban Gamliel, and he says, I will not listen. He replied to them, I will not listen to you to remove from myself the kingship of heaven even for one moment. He justifies, or he explains his behavior. He says, yes, I taught you that. I know I taught that. I know that's what's in the Mishnah, or I know that's what will be codified in the Mishnah as normative law. But why did I not practice in what I preached? Why did I behave differently? Because my thirst for, my yearning for the kingship of heaven is so intense. I cannot not say Kriyat Shema. I don't care what the normative practice is. I don't care. But I can't not say Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema is Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim. It's declaring my belief in God. I can't for even one night, and I will not listen to you. I will not even listen to me, right? I won't even listen to you. I have to say Shema. And I have to say Shema. It's interesting, I think, because, and this has all kinds of implications for contemporary debates or discussions or that are going on in the Jewish world, the reason that I can't follow normative Jewish law is precisely because my religious passion is so great. It's for spiritual and religious reasons that I have to deviate from halachic practice. This is a fascinating moment. I think you'll all concede for a minute. Rabban Gamliel, whoever Rabban Gamliel is, he is expressing an attention that I think many of us feel today when we talk about our religious motive, a passion, leading us to deviate from normative halachic practice, okay? Now, back again to your question before, but it said it was an exemption. I mean, he wasn't doing anything prohibited. He was just not accepting an exemption. It's interesting that the disciples, when they say, but you taught us, feel that there's still a tension, even though it's just ke'ilu. Okay, it was an exemption and you didn't choose to take it. There's still something that's disturbing the disciples where the exemption is instituted into practice and you choose not to take it. It's disturbing to us, your community. Think of examples, maybe perhaps, of rabbinic figures, right? I hope this won't distract us too much. It probably will. But a rabbinic figure who, for instance, gives a hechsher to a restaurant and then wouldn't eat there themselves, okay? Or gives a heter to do something and then chooses not to follow that heter in their own practice. The disciples are disturbed by this. What do you mean? If you're exempt, you're exempt. Why are you saying the Shema? And he says, I can't do otherwise. I can't do otherwise. Okay?
Maybe he's talking about chayav as opposed to patur. It's either you're chayav or you're patur. And if you're patur, you're patur. It's the extent that lo chayav means that you're
okay.
Like you can't.
And there's
do
something.
It.
There's something. There's an air. Potentially, there's something. Even there's something that in the act of saying, okay.
It's like levat halach.
Yeah, this is what all of you guys do, but it's not. Okay, Nachon, there's a lot of subtext here. We could talk about this for a long, long time. We have to move on. Let's move to the second. Because even for those of you who thought, well, okay, still he's being more machmir on himself, he's being stricter, he's taking on obligations, okay, I can live with that. Anyway, some of us actually are very happy for our rabbis to be more machmir than we are, right? We feel kind of, you know, we feel kind of reassured. Okay, my rabbi, he's really right. Let's read the second clause, the second Mishnah. The same Rabban Gamliel, we're told by the Mishnah, bathed on the first night after the death of his wife. Now the transition, of course, is very dramatic. A moment ago, we were celebrating Rabban Gamliel's marriage. And in Mishnah Bet, in the next Mishnah, we are marking the death of his wife. Now, of course, we all hope that there were, 60, 70, 80 years of a happy marriage in between Mishnah, the first Mishnah and the second Mishnah. We don't really know. We'd assume so. It wasn't as immediate. But it's very abrupt. I think we have the sense, that sense, it's styled in a way that we're kind of a bit caught, But we're at two very intimate moments, personal moments in Rabban Gamliel's personal life that are documented in a very public document that we watch and observe and think, and once again, demonstrating how much in the public eye is this man and always has been in so much of his personal life events, so much of his personal life is conducted in the public eye, in the spotlight, right? And what does that do to one? Okay, let's go back. So he bathes on the first night after the death of his wife. His disciples said to him, "Have you not taught us, our master, that a mourner is forbidden to bathe? Rechatsa is one of the things that a mourner is not allowed to do. How could you have bathed on the night of your wife's death? You're an avel. You can't bathe." Now, for those of us who maybe perhaps were a little bit more, were more comfortable here, we're talking about a leniency. There's a prohibition that he has just exempted himself from, okay? In other words, Rabban Gamliel has just transgressed a prohibition. It's not waived an exemption, okay? He's not been more machmir. He's being mekel on himself. He's being much more lenient with himself. And once again, the disciples are there watching and asking, "What are you doing? How could you do this?" And listen very carefully to his answer. He replied to them, "I am not like other men. I am delicate." Okay? The original says istanis ani. Now the term istanis, right? The term istanis is a recurring term within rabbinic sources. It depicts a person of a personality type that cannot bear dirt, cannot bear discomfort, I don't know myself. I've been debating about this, thinking about this for a long time, whether it's a characteristic trait. Some people just really, really need order and comfort, and it's really a characteristic. I'm not sure if it doesn't cross the line into being almost a personality disorder. It's serious. No, I mean this. In a halachic discourse, it's a serious condition. It's a condition that has to be recognized as being existing. And for instance, an istanis is patur from sleeping in the sukkah. Some people just can't. They can't sleep outdoors, right? I don't know if you know people like that, but there are people like that yourselves. Some people can't do it. They can't sleep outdoors. The Talmud halacha recognizes that. It says if you're an istanis, you don't have to. Rabban Gamliel says, I'm an istanis. I can't not bathe. So yes, normative halacha is that a mourner can't bathe, but I'm an istanis. I'm different. Now, there's a phrase here that Rabban Gamliel uses that I want to, for a moment, zoom in on and suggest. I'm already giving away, it's late already, it's time to start giving away something. If I was to choose a heading for Rabban Gamliel, I think he has just said something, maybe he didn't intend to, but I think he's revealed something very deep about himself, and that, or about his sense of self, and that is, I am not like other men. Eini kishar kol adam. Right? Now, the truth is, when I look back at his history, I say to myself, you know, He's not like other men. To be born into a dynasty, to be born into a royal family, to have this fate, this destiny thrust on you, to have greatness chosen for you, thrust on you. That was the word I'm looking for. Yes. It really, you do have a feeling. I'm not like everybody else. Everybody else, you know, chooses their career. Everybody else chooses what to do. I never had a choice. I am from the beginning to end, I am not like other men. His delicacy, by the way, the fact that he's Easternese also leads me to think about certain things. Is that a reflection also? Right? Who becomes an Easternese? Is there also a suggestion here maybe of... What? Perfectionism? A certain perfectionism? Need to be perfect, but also maybe also certain socioeconomic status? Maybe, I mean, who develops this inability to be exposed to? Maybe there's a suggestion here of privilege also. To be an Easternis might, I don't know, whatever, just again is a possibility. Rabban Gamliel... Rabban Gamliel is coming through, I think, already here as being a very intense reality. There are professionals here in the room that can either confirm this or not. But someone once suggested to me that there's something else also in common with the two practices that Rabban Gamliel is described as practicing in deviation from normative halacha. Both in the previous one and in this one. Now, they're different. We already noted the differences. They share something in common. They do share, however, something. First of all, they share something in common. The obvious thing is, of course, his wife, okay? The marriage and the death. And I kind of wonder about the relationship, okay? This man who insisted on saying Shema on his wedding night, but couldn't not bathe when his wife. I kind of wonder about that. We don't know that. We don't know, I think, anything about Rabban Gamliel and his wife or the relationship. But it's just interesting. But there's something I think even more striking about that both share in common. And that is in both cases, Rabban Gamliel appears to be unwilling or maybe incapable of not doing that which he usually does. And this need for stability, this need for, maybe I'll even say it, routine. Now again, I don't have the credentials for, nor I think is it responsible to diagnose Rabban Gamliel, but it has been suggested to me that these are actually characteristics that are often associated with people that are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. This need for regularity, for things to be stable. I can't not do tonight. I can't not say the Shema. If I say the Shema every night, I have to say the Shema every night. if I bathe every day, I have to bathe every day. I don't have that inner flexibility that other people have, that ordinary people have, okay? Mm-hmm. And I, again, that sense of being different, that sense of maybe requiring a certain stability that other people have, maybe the ability to sometimes forego on. So that's another thing to maybe perhaps keep in mind. There's yet, Mishnah 7 also adds a third round to that, but given our short amount of time here, it's crazy, our short amount of time. So I'm going to skip the number 7 and just go straight to number 8, because I do want to note for you something interesting that happens at the end of this collection of Mishnayot. The Mishnah actually ends this piece by saying, if a bridegroom desires to recite the Shema, going back to the first Mishnah, for closure, and saying, actually, if a bridegroom wants to say Shema, he may do so. Now, what's clear, I think, is that this formulation of this permission for all bridegrooms, should they choose to say the Shema, may do so, didn't exist or wasn't in anyone's awareness in the first Mishnah, because then the disciples, if Rabban Gamliel had taught this already originally along with the exemption that it was an option, then the disciples wouldn't have asked the question in the first place. In other words, what I think we're actually looking at, and this is interesting in many ways beyond the scope of Rabban Gamliel's life story, it's an interesting halachic dynamic. Because what apparently has happened is if in the first Mishnah, Rabban Gamliel rebels against or deviates from the halachic practice, the halachic norm. And by Mishnah 8, right, 3 Mishnayot later, what was deviant in the first Mishnah is now normatized. It becomes normative practice, right? The avant-garde, as it were, of the first Mishnah, that singular individual who says, but I can't, I need to, I want to, then brings about, because that in turn becomes the normative norm, and everyone is now granted that permission to consider themselves or to express sometimes that sense of not being able to follow the norm, and it becomes normative in and of itself. The deviation becomes normative, right? Okay, however, there's a voice of opposition brought at the very end of the mission, and I want to draw your attention to that. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the son, says, not everyone who desires to, excuse me, not everyone who desires to assume the name may do so. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, the practice of my father, that which my father allowed himself to do, to step out of the norm, whether lechumra or lekula, whether to wave, is not something that everyone may do. That is something that only few may do. Maybe only my father, Rabban Gamliel, may do so, and leading us to once again wonder about, is this individual a representative of the community, or is he different? Is he just different with a capital D? And Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel his son seems to be insisting, my father is different, and don't model after my father normative practice that is to be applied to everyone, okay? Okay, we'll see more of this. We now have to pick up speed. Okay, here's a story. Out of all the stories of Rabban Gamliel that we're going to try and read tonight, this is probably the least well known. But I don't want to miss it, because I think it again gives us some insights into Rabban Gamliel's character, as well as highlighting a relationship that has yet not been highlighted, and that is the relationship between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua that is going to play a very important role in Rabban Gamliel's life and Rabbi Yoshua's life, as we've seen previously. Okay, here we are. Illustrated in the case of Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua, that's the link with the previous discussion in the Gemara. Babylonian Talmud, Bavli Horayot. They once traveled on board a ship. Rabban Gamliel had with him some bread only, while Rabbi Yoshua had with him bread and flour. When Rabban Gamliel's bread was consumed, he depended on Rabbi Yoshua's flour. Did you know, the former asked him, right? Rabban Gamliel asks Rabbi Yoshua, did you know that we should be so much delayed that you brought flour with you? Right? Rabban Gamliel is amazed at the savviness of Rabbi Yoshua. How did you know to pack a sandwich? Okay, have you ever been in that situation where your flight's delayed, right? And the person next to you has their toothbrush and has a supper and has tomorrow's breakfast and they're so well prepared, and you say, how did you know to pack? Bring along all these provisions. Rabbi Yoshua answers Rabban Gamliel. The latter answered him, a certain star arises once in 70 years and leads the sailors astray. And I suspected it might rise and lead us astray. Okay? Now, I know my intonation. I can't help it. When I read, I clearly am also interpreting. I can't see this answer as being anything but sarcastic. I mean, once in 70 years, the sailors are led astray and there's a delay in travel. I mean, come on, right? Travel hasn't changed that much. There are delays all the time. Who doesn't know this?
They did sarcasm back then?
Oh, for sure. I have no question in my mind. Someone once told me that somewhere that the Talmud is full of humor and sarcasm. And someone once said to me that the Jewish people lost their sense of humor somewhere between the Talmud and the Rishonim and the Piskei. And so much of the statements of the Talmud that were said sarcastically were then codified into normative halakha and affect our lives to this very day. It might be true. I think there's no question to me. There's no question in my mind. In any case, if we freeze the screen for a minute, okay, and say to ourselves, what are we watching? We're watching these two men. They're both on board a ship. We don't know, although I think it will be suggested in a minute that they're actually, although they're on the board ship together, they're not necessarily traveling for the same purposes. Rabban Gamliel travels a lot. It's probably associated with his position as the patriarch. The patriarch is recognized by the government, by the Roman government, as holding office, as being the representative. And there are they travel to Rome, they travel to all kinds of travels in his office. Rabbi Yeshua apparently is either possibly also accompanying Rabban Gamliel, but also, as it will soon be, I think, suggested, is also there on his own personal needs, his own personal business. It's a business trip for Rabbi Yeshua as well. We'll see that in a minute. In any case, what's clear? Who's Rabban Gamliel? Or what image is coming through?
He's not thinking ahead.
He's kind of clueless. Nahon, he's kind of clueless, which might come along with being
hampered.
Being privileged. But he's not used to having to pack his own tent. He's used to other people taking care. He doesn't really know that much. Maybe we're projecting. In any case, he relies on Rabbi Yeshua's cloud. Rabbi Yeshua answers him with a certain kind of indulgence, possibly. Now Rabban Gamliel's response, he says, "You possess so much knowledge, I'm so impressed," the former said to him, "and yet you must travel on board a ship. How interesting," right? Now, there are all kinds of ways to take this, I think. Yeah. Possibly one is
Yes.
But what does he say? You're so smart,
but you have to be like the rest.
But you're like the rest of us. You're also on the trip. There also might be, and many, actually, Rashi, I didn't bring Rashi on this, this is from the Gemara, Rashi has a commentary on this. Rashi actually suggests, I think actually Rashi also thinks that there's some banter going on between these two men. And what Rabban Gamliel's dig back at Rabbi Yeshua is, you're so smart, and yet you have to travel on this ship for the purposes of a business, of making a living, right? You're so smart. Now, on the other hand, here am I. I'm the patriarch. I'm here on official business. I'm going to travel to see the Roman emperor, maybe perhaps. You're here on a business trip. You're making a living. And look, who's smart, okay? Who's smart now, okay? Let's see, really. There's a bit of a competitiveness here that's reflecting itself in this maybe friendly banter that's somewhat biting, somewhat sarcastic, somewhat back and forth. Beginning, I think the relationship is beginning to emerge, right? This is a friendship, but it's a friendship that has mutual digs and mutual. And he says, and you're so smart, but you've got to still travel on a ship. You've got to work so hard to make a living. Look at you and look at me, right? Who's smart and who's smart now? And now I think at this point, Rabbi Yeshua loses his sense of humor. Okay, now Rabbi Yeshua responds and he says, listen carefully. The other replied, rather than be surprised at me, marvel at two disciples you have on land, Rabbi Elazar Chisma and Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgeda, who are able to calculate how many drops there are in the sea and yet have neither bread to eat nor raiment to put on. Right? And here I think is where the tone changes. Here is where Rabbi Yeshua says, okay, banter, banter, fun, citizens, mutual, whatever. There's something, now we've just touched on a serious point. You, Rabban Gamliel, have no idea. You have no idea what it is. When he touches on that having to work for your living, as opposed to, that's where Rabbi Yeshua turns serious. And he says, you have no idea. Now this accusation, we don't have time to read all of the stories of Rabban Gamliel tonight, but some of you might be familiar with some of them. This is an accusation that will come up time and again regarding Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel does not have a clue how hard it is to survive, to just survive.
Like Bush's mistake.
What?
Like Bush's mistake in the supermarket.
Ken, nachon, you really have no idea. And that's not funny. And you have these two students who are brilliant, and they can barely scrape together anything to eat or anything to wear. Rabban Gamliel, and this I have to say definitely to his credit, hears. He listens, and Rabbi Yoshua plays that role in Rabban Gamliel's life. Rabbi Yoshua is that buddy slash advisor slash a companion who holds Rabban Gamliel in some kind of eye contact with the real world, and he decides, as a result of this conversation, Rabban Gamliel decides to appoint them. He says, when I go back home, I'm going to give those two a job. Here, by the way, is one of the indications, one of the powers that the patriarch actually holds. You can hear the patriarch controls a lot of jobs, okay? He can appoint, certainly within the rabbinic world. Now, this is going to be something we're going to come back to when we talk about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. The patriarch holds a lot of power, particularly over rabbinic positions. And Rabban Gamliel decides, okay, he's going to give these two a job on the recommendation of Rabbi Yoshua. When he landed, he sent for them. But they did not come. Now, Rabban Gamliel, why they did not come, I don't know, but we'll see in a minute why Rabban Gamliel thinks they didn't come. He sent for them a second time. And when they came, he said to them, do you imagine that I offer you rulership? In other words, he thought that these men were not coming because out of maybe humility or out of a desire not to. He says, do you think I'm about to offer you something? A rulership? I'm offering you srara, it says in the original. Nahon, I'm offering you a position of power, authority. It's servitude that I offer you. As it is said, and he quotes a pasuk from Melachim, and they spoke to him, saying, if thou wilt be a servant to do this people this day, this is the advice that Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, receives, and does not heed, by the way, that he should consider himself as the king, he should consider himself a servant to the people. And Rabban Gamliel says, you think I'm offering you a position of authority? Anything grand? Anything great? I'm offering you servitude by appointing you in some kind of position. Now, once again, I think Rabban Gamliel has just revealed something very important about his own self-perception. He is the patriarch, but he tells us that position of patriarchy is servitude. It's servitude. I'm a slave to my own destiny. I'm a servant to my own role. I have no choice. I have perhaps no freedom. Believe me, what I'm giving you is no great gift, right? Privilege and burdens are something that follow Rabban Gamliel's stories. That Rabban Gamliel, yes, he has a privileged position. He even has a result. He has power. He has authority. He has wealth as well that comes along with this position. But all of those privileges are experienced by him. And time and again, that slips through. Whether he intends to or not, he lets us know that privileges are sometimes very burdensome. And they're servitude. Basically, it's not rulership, it's servitude. And that's the story of my life, Rabban Gamliel says. I was born into this servitude, and I am destined to remain here. And that's so much part of who and what I am. We have just barely 15 minutes left. We're going to try and squeeze in a very packed and intense story that is one of the central dramas of the rabbinic narrative, and one of the rare moments where the Mishnah tells us a very detailed, full-blown narrative story. The Mishnah usually is very concise. It usually restricts itself to halachic material. The Talmud can go off on telling us these three-page stories of the Oven of Achnai and others. It is rare that the Mishnah tells such a long, developed, rich in detail story as the one that we're about to read here. So we started with a Mishnaic text, and we're continuing, probably ending, with a Mishnaic text as well. And actually, I want to note as we do that, Remember, and this will be important to us in a moment, that maybe it's not coincidental that some of the central stories that narrate the story and paint the portrait of Rabban Gamliel are found in the Mishnah. Let's remember, this is the Mishnah that will be produced by his grandson. Okay? So the story that we're about to read is at least, if not authored by, it's at least edited by his grandson. And that is going to make a difference, as I hope we will have time to demonstrate. Okay, here we are. We're in the Mishnah and Rosh Hashanah. The overall theme of Rosh Hashanah, well, besides Rosh Hashanah, of course, is the calendar, is the setting of the calendar. And amongst other topics, we talk, have the Mishnah discusses pronouncing of the new moon, right? Setting the Chodesh, Rosh Chodesh, how the new moon is decided upon, announced, publicized. This is before the time where the calendar was set in advance. It would happen in real time. You would discover, is today the 29th, the 30th of Kislev, or is it the 1st of Tevet? You would not be able to look in advance in a calendar. That would be determined in real time. This, too, is one of the responsibilities that falls under the job description of the patriarch. It is the patriarch who oversees and supervises the setting of the new moon, the setting of the new month. This is also extremely important because this regulates and creates a cohesiveness within the Jewish community, obviously, right? When the month is determined, that determines the rhythm of the Jewish year, and he holds this authority in his hand to determine how the community, how the Jewish world will observe and celebrate, right, all of the holidays. So it's a particularly important role that the patriarch fills throughout the generations. So the Mishnah tells us the following. Rabban Gamliel used to have images of the moon on a tablet hanging on the wall of his upper chamber, on which he would show those who were unlearned and say, did it look like this or like this? Okay, when the witnesses would come to testify, we've seen the new moon. Well, those who were educated and articulate could describe verbally what they saw, but not everyone is articulate and educated. And therefore, he would have all these diagrams, these teaching aids, right? He'd say, and they were, it really sounds like he had, they were, the, let's go back to that introductory statement. Rabban Gamliel had images of the moon on a tablet in his upper chamber. Okay, now I took that out of context for a moment and just read you that description. Yes, it's spooky, okay? It's spooky. What do you mean? Did I just read that right? He used to have images of the moon on a tablet in his upper chamber? The patriarch of Israel, Rabban Gamliel. Now, the Talmud Bavli actually responds exactly that same way. The Talmud Bavli says, what? What? Is that permitted? Literally, the Talmud says, Mishari, is that permitted to have images of the moon in your upper chamber? Eventually, interestingly enough, after a long discussion, the Talmud resolves that it is, of course, permitted, but it's primarily permitted because he's the patriarch, right? And that ties in with some themes. We don't have time to develop all of them. Let's continue the narrative, just holding that image for a minute. And I will come back to it at the very, very end of today's presentation, which is very soon. What has happened? The two witnesses came and testified. We saw it in the morning of the 29th in the east and in the evening of the 30th in the west. Right? They testified a strange testimony. In the morning, the moon was in the east side of the sky, and by the evening, it was in the west. Said Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, those are false witnesses. Okay, the moon doesn't travel that fast in the sky. You can't see it in the morning on one side and the evening on the other. However, when they came to Yafne, Rabban Gamliel accepted their testimony, and on the basis of which he announced the new month to have begun. On another occasion, two witnesses came and testified, we saw it on the expected time, in other words, the night preceding the 30th, the night between the 29th and the 30th, but on the night of its intercalation, in other words, the night after the 31st, it was not seen. In other words, we saw it yesterday, but tonight it's gone again. And Rabban Gamliel accepted their testimony, said Rabbi Dosa ben Horkanos, they're false witnesses. How can you testify that a woman has given birth while on the next day her belly is between her teeth? It's an interesting description of advanced pregnancy. No, we don't have time right now. Rabbi Yoshua said to him, I see your words. I see your point. Okay, Rabbanga, they accepted this, but by definition, internally, the testimony itself is so strange, and so it doesn't sound likely that that would be true. And Rabbi Yoshua expresses his agreement with Rabbi Dosa ben Horkinus that this is a very strange testimony to have accepted. Rabban Gamliel said to him, word must have come to Rabban Gamliel that Rabbi Yoshua had said this, and he sends him immediately a message. I decree upon you that you come to me with your staff and money on the day which according to you will be Yom Kippur. Okay? So he calls him to order. Given their lack of time, I want to already draw your attention to an interesting fact, okay, which strikes me as being interesting. This message seems to be sent solely to Rabbi Yoshua. Why not Rabbi Yosef ben Horkinus? Why not Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri? There were three people, as a matter of fact, there were two people who... Why is he targeting only Rabbi Yoshua is something that we need to think about. Now, it might have to do with...
Status.
Okay, Rabbi Yoshua is so important.
He's a threat.
He's a threat. If Rabbi Yoshua rebels against my authority, it might be public, it might be communal. In other words, the impact that this might have, it might also be personal, right? Personal, you, Rabbi Yoshua, you're turning against me? That's the last person. I need you. Right? I can't allow that. Okay, so there are all kinds of possibilities. You'll have to think about it, some of it also yourself. In any case, Rabbi Akiva went and found him in great distress. He said to him, I can bring you proof that whatever Rabban Gamliel has done is valid. For it says, the following are God's appointed holy days that you will designate in their appointed times. He brings a verse from which we can derive whether they're designated in their proper time or not at their proper time. I, God says, I have no holy days save these. Right? So Rabbi Akiva finds Rabbi Yoshua, presumably in great distress, right? That's what it seems to say. And he says to him, I can tell you that what? What is he saying?
It's okay.
It's okay
to
you accept Rabban Gamliel's order. God himself has authorized, right, the Bet Din to determine when the new moon begins. And the new moon will begin. God will confirm whatever it is the Beit Din says will be is confirmed by God. God says that. That's the agreement that God has already basically, right, given us, is he will accept as the appointed seasons that which Rabban Gamliel calls the shots. There's no absolute truth out there that Rabban Gamliel has to discern, what he says is now there's a moment here. I wish we had more time, but there's something here very strange. First of all, I want to draw your attention to, we have a diagram still on the board. Who's speaking? Rabbi Akiva. Who's he speaking to? Speaking to Rabbi Yoshua. Okay, now, first of all, is this the way a student speaks to his teacher in the rabbinic world? Does a student come, find their teacher in great distress, and say, Yesh li lelamdecha, I can teach you a thing or two, okay? Surely the verse says this is a. That's just not protocol. That's not the way students speak to teachers. Okay, it shouldn't be anywhere, but it certainly is not the way students speak to teachers in the rabbinic world. So that's already odd. I'm feeling a little uncomfortable. What's going on here? But if we look, so the style is a little odd. It's a little off. But when you think of the content, there's something that's additionally off. What is Rabbi Akiva teaching Rabbi Yoshua?
Yes, but
who's Rabbi Yoshua? Who's Rabbi Yoshua? We know something about Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua is Mr. Lo b'shamayim, nachon? Rabbi Yoshua is the man who stood on his feet and said Lo b'shamayim. What does Lo b'shamayim mean? We said the halacha. We said to Rabbi Yoshua said to the bat kol, okay? Lo b'shamayim. We determine what halacha is, not. Does Rabbi Yoshua need Rabbi Akiva to come around and teach him to accept Rabban Gamliel's authority that God has authorized Rabban Gamliel to determine halacha? Rabbi Yoshua is the mastermind of that inspired idea.
Maybe this is where Akiva teaches as well.
So now the question is which story came first? Which, of course, if so, is very dramatic because it means it all came from Rabbi Akiva, right? right? If Rabbi Yehoshua learned this here from Rabbi Akiva, then when Rabbi Yehoshua stands on his feet and says, Lo b'shamayim, and then it puts a different spin also on the fact that they send Rabbi Akiva to tell Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Okay.
Another possibility, Lo b'shamayim, he isn't saying, he's saying the majority rules.
Yes.
It's not, the but called this rules, the majority. Here, he thinks that perhaps that Rabbi Gamliel is going out on his own.
Manyan. So there are nuanced differences that might be hard to explain. Okay. There's the next stage is he appears to be convinced. He appears to be, or at least have listened very carefully. He goes back to Rabbi Yosef ben Hyrcanus. If we remember, he was the one who expressed dissent in the first place, to which he expressed his own agreement. He goes to Rabbi Yosef ben Hyrcanus, who said to him that, by the way, is a choice. I think it's ambiguous. It's not clear quite who's saying to who. If we question the ruling of the Beit Din of Rabban Gamliel, we must question the ruling of every Beit Din from the times of Moshe up to the present day. We can't do this. We can't shake the foundations of authority. We have to accept their authority. And then he brings a different pasuk. And Moshe ascended, because it says Moshe ascended with Aaron, Nadav, and Abihu, the 70 elders of Israel. Now, why were the 70 elders of Israel not specified? To show that every group of sages that form a Beit Din is considered as the Beit Din of Moshe and Aaron. In other words, the authority of the office is not dependent on the individual occupying the office. It is the office itself, it's the Beit Din itself that holds the authority. The faces of the individuals who are occupying the positions on the Beit Din are not what gives it its authority. It's an institutional authority. Between you and me, Rabbi Yosef ben Hyrcanus and Rabbi Yehoshua are saying, it's not all about Rabban Gamliel and whether he's right or wrong, or whether he's clever or not, or whether he's... It's about... We listen to him, we accept his authority, not on virtue by virtue of his personal authority, or his personal charisma, or his personal wisdom and knowledge. We accept his authority because he's the patriarch.
Because
he's the Beit Din. And the Beit Din is faceless, the Beit Din is anonymous. Now, Rabbi Yehoshua accepts this, and as you know, there's a very, many of you know, there's a very moving ending to this story, where he comes to Rabban, he indeed collects his things, and on Yom Kippur, according to his calculation, he goes to Rabban Gamliel, and Rabban Gamliel understands fully what's just happened, and he rises and kisses him on his head, and says to him, come in peace, my master and my disciple, my master in wisdom. Right? Rabban Gamliel recognizes that Rabbi Yehoshua is his master in wisdom. He does not assert his own wisdom over that of Rabbi Yehoshua. But you are my disciple because you accepted my words. Rabban Gamliel, I think, has the... If he didn't have enough on his plate already, of the responsibility of continuing the dynasty. By the way, with hindsight, those who are telling his story also know that he not only has the responsibility back to his ancestors before him to continue their dynasty, but he also has a responsibility towards the future. Because if he doesn't do this, we're not going to get to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and we all know what's at stake. In other words, there's a huge historical burden on the shoulders of this man. Just to be the bridge, to be the reestablishment of the line, so that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi can be and achieve and do what that which he was, is yet to do. He also has the, but yeah, however, he has the I don't know, misfortune. He has the particular destiny and fate of having to do this in a particularly traumatic time in history. And I would add, just as this story I think has just highlighted, that he has the added burden of having to assert his leadership in a time where there are giants of Torah in his generation, giants of intellect, of spirituality, right? Now, go lead, right? Go be appointed leader and patriarch when your contemporaries are Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, and Rabbi Lazar ben Arach, and their disciple is Rabbi Akiva, and you have to be the patriarch. Now, Rabban Gamliel, I think, time and again, is conscious or made conscious of the fact that his authority is not personal. It's not individual. It's not because he outshines all of the others. It's precisely because it's precisely because he holds this office that gives him. And it's the recognition of that. He has to come to terms with that. and his contemporaries have come to terms with that. And once that has come, once we recognize that, then it works. It can work. It does work. But it has to be recognized. Just going to suggest, since we're trying to run out of time, but I'm going to suggest that if you want to look ahead in some of the sources, you might see that this story apparently has been edited somewhat by Rabbi Yehuda Hanassi, his grandson. Because the story is retold, or certain points in the story are retold in the Talmud Bavli, or told differently in the Talmud Bavli, in ways that you will see could have been even more offensive and more in your face to Rabban Gamliel than actually was reported in the Mishnah. In other words, even this very strong story where Rabban Gamliel has to assert his authority has been toned down somewhat by Rabbi Yehuda Hanassi's editing. If you look at the versions, I've included them in the source packet so you can look at them afterwards, you'll see how much harsher this story could have been and might have historically been, and was toned down. That's what, I guess, the advantage is of having, you know, the editor read on your yoke. But the tensions of Rabban Gamliel's life, of a private individual occupying public office, and the tensions that brings to the surface, I think we've already got a taste of, at least tonight, and you can continue to trace as you read more and more about and of this man.
In the story of his death, it's also connected to the wound.
Okay. There are many connections also. I also, there's another source there, I think, which also predicts back to the images of the moon. He has, the moon is a messianic emblem as well. Okay. The moon is associated with the house of David, and it's particularly associated with the waxing and the waning, which I think actually Rabban Gamliel, I'll risk a bit of a speculative statement here, maybe draws comfort from, but the moon is not consistently whole. The moon doesn't always appear to be complete. Sometimes it appears to be lacking, appears to be missing, and yet it's still the moon. It's still the moon that will produce, that symbolizes the house of David. And maybe perhaps coming back to those images of the moon that he has in his attic might be again a source of comfort. I don't have to be perfect. You said about perfectionism before, right? Maybe he dreams of perfectionism, but he knows he's not perfect. He's not perfect. Certainly in the generation of these giants, he doesn't outshine them. But he's the moon. He stole the moon. And that's very significant. I think that's very comforting to him as well. And you can see that in the source as well, that he possibly identifies with. Yeah, so I think it's very...
Was he the one that was removed from the position of that scene?
Yeah. We just didn't have enough time to...
Just too many people to say the same thing. Why wasn't sure about that?
I actually just posted about this on Facebook yesterday, so I'm a little, when I walked in and I heard you were talking about Rabbi Gamliel, I was like, oh my god. So, can I use your marker?
Okay. Oh, you can hear this. Awesome. Thank you.